Okay, so welcome back to the afternoon session. At this time, I'd like to introduce Dr. John Bolton. John is serving as the Associate Program Manager of Water Resources for the NASA Applied Sciences Program. His research focuses on the application of satellite-based remote sensing and land surface hydrological modeling for improved ecological and water resource management. He is involved in several water resource management efforts in the Middle East, Central and North Africa, Southeast Asia, and the United States. And over lunch, I just found out he passed up an opportunity to tour the White House today so that he could be here instead. So please help me welcome Dr. John Bolton.
Thank you. This is way more exciting. That lunch, I think that lunch alone was worth it. So, thank you guys so much. I really appreciate this. It's a great honor to be able to speak in front of the Minnesota Groundwater Association. So I work at NASA. I'm at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. And half my time is spent doing research in the hydrological sciences lab. The other half I serve as the associate program manager. And I have the privilege of working with our large portfolio of projects and people that are working within the applied sciences program. So today I'm going to just tell a story, talk about some of the work that NASA does. The first thing I hear, most people are like, NASA, what is NASA doing with Earth observations? What do they do? So, and it's something I really enjoy talking about. So, and I will start with the blue marble. It's one of my favorite pictures. So you look at this, and what we see, there's a lot of blue, and there's a lot of white. All this is water. And if you think right now, as of about an hour ago when I checked, there's the population of the Earth is 7.4 billion people. Now, I have a 4-year-old daughter, and by the time she's my age, the population of the planet is expected to be 9 billion people. It's almost a 20% increase in just a few years. So we're all tasked with how can we feed 9 billion people with the same amount of resources? And it's a big challenge. So the global water cycle. I really don't need to educate you all on this, but I do like to start with this and talk about the motivation and how we treat the Earth as a system and how we do this. And, so it's all about precipitation. And the global water cycle is how this water moves from water falling or evaporating from the ocean, being carried through evapotranspiration onto land, and being run off. And some of it is stored as groundwater because there's a little bit more that falls over land than is evaporated. And when you break this down into the different components of how this water is being used and how it's stored and how it's transferred over land, this is where it becomes challenging. Because how is this water used for agriculture and industry, and how are we using it as a system overall? So the challenge here is to take each one of these, each component here, and as accurately as possible, monitor, understand and forecast that variable so we can better understand and so we can prepare for the future 9 billion people that are going to live on the planet. So I like this figure. It's from Shannon in, I think, 1978. He called it the water landscape. And it's another way of looking at the propagation of water through these different storage areas, from how much water is being stored through vegetation for trees, how much is being lost through evapotranspiration, and how much water is being stored through soil moisture, groundwater, and how this is transferred through the system. So when we address drought, we address meteorological drought, how much water, there's a deficit in precipitation, and that results in a hydrological drought, how much water there's a deficit in stream flow, and then through agricultural drought, there's less water available for agriculture and plants. So the challenge here is to take each component here and see, well, using in situ data and using Earth observations, which I'll be talking about, how can we best constrain each component here? And I'll start off by saying there's really no substitution for ground data. I love satellites, I love UAVs and aerial observations, but they're really just a proxy and an additional observation that can be combined with in-situ observations. So if we look at the distribution of water on Earth, just a tiny fraction is on land and stored in glaciers. The rest is in the oceans. So we have very, very little to work with, especially the small component that is left for groundwater. And I can't, my glasses are bad, so I can't really read that. But anyway, so how much is broken out for freshwater use in each component? This needs to be addressed as well. So as the population increases, as there's more an increase in food insecurity worldwide, and there's more of an issues of transboundary water issues, we're all tasked with taking the small component of water, keeping it clean, managing it as accurately as possible. So the objectives of the Water Resources Program in NASA is to provide an integrated system to help understand the Earth as a whole. And this will hopefully explain the basic underlying science and interactions of this. So if we understand it better, hopefully we can manage it better. So this is a source by population labs of estimated global population density. You can see areas of the globe. You can see India is bright red, okay? You look at the projected global population density over the years, and as you might expect, some areas become redder and redder and redder. Now, when you combine that with the global runoff and recharge, you have an estimate of available blue water availability per capita. And the amount of red on this map is pretty scary to me, actually. So this motivates the whole problem. So how can we deal with this this forecasted decrease in available blue water per capita? So show me the water. I added this just a few minutes ago. I thought it was funny. So talking about drought and water shortage, you know, maybe caused by drought, overuse of available water and resources, and pollution. So we need to integrate socioeconomic data, water use, combined with water availability, and this is a big challenge. So globally, I mentioned almost a third of the planet's population lacks access to proper sanitation and water, and almost a billion people lack access to adequate fresh water. And this leads to widespread disease, and this is a pretty scary statistic I just found, but it'll wake you up after lunch, I guess. So if you take how many people die from waterborne diseases, diarrheal diseases, equivalent to 12 Boeing 747s crashing a day. This is a pretty alarmist statement, but it's true. So, and if you look at the impact of that, just from a financial standpoint, the 2011 Texas drought cost $7.6 billion. And the U.S. drought in 2012 cost nearly $40 billion. So this is all leading up to why we are looking at Earth as a whole and why we're monitoring the blue marble. So, I was putting this together. This is how we do this in situ. So we have to properly constrain each component of the water cycle. So rain and snowfall, you have precipitation gauges, you have your sensors, you have snow depth and snow water equivalent is even more challenging. Go out with rulers, capture this. Evapotranspiration is done with flux towers, groundwater, obviously, or that's soil moisture, and surface water and river flow, and also groundwater. So there's, as I mentioned, there's really no substitution for in situ observations, but there's an, if you want to get a regional perspective, if you want to have a global perspective and try to understand this as a system, I can tell you how wet the soil is right there, but I have trouble telling you what is 50 yards away or 50 miles away unless we integrate a numerical model or we add more observations. So this is sort of motivates the whole problem. I have some figures of the distribution of the telecommunication system stations. These are groundwater stations, and this is river flow observations. And all these networks are decreasing in number through time. So we have remote sensing and modeling of the blue marble. So NASA actually has a constellation of 18 satellites that are dedicated to observing different components of the water cycle. And I'm going to present a few of these and talk about some applications that are being performed through the operational integration of these data into management practices. So for precipitation, a lot of people use the TRIM satellite. TRIM satellite is tropical rainfall measuring mission is about to fall out of the sky. So NASA has the global precipitation measurement mission. So this provides a high resolution every 30 minute all over the entire globe. You have estimates of precipitation. And a lot of people use MODIS, and a lot of our work applies this the moderate resolution imaging spectrometer, and this is a workhorse in our work. The soil moisture active passive or SMAP mission was just launched in 2015, and a lot of my work is actually focused on SMAP applications. And what's so unique about this is it's the first ever mission that's dedicated to monitoring soil moisture from space, and this is a microwave-based system that monitors the microwave emission and also radar backscatter from the surface. And it turns out that soil moisture is a critical component of the water cycle, of course, but it's also a critical component for understanding the land-atmosphere interaction. And so I have a few examples later on where we're talking about how we can take this soil moisture data, we can use this as a leading indicator for future vegetation anomalies. It's pretty cool. So and when I started this work many years ago, they were saying, well, one day there's going to be a satellite that can do soil moisture from space. And it was just launched last year, so it's exciting for me. So the surface water ocean topography mission is planned for launch, I believe, in 2020. And this is an altimetry mission that is focused on monitoring reservoir and river height from space. So it's pretty amazing if you think about it. If you have a satellite about 540 kilometers in altitude, that it can tell you the height of a reservoir or river within 2 to 3 centimeters. It's pretty amazing. So from this, we can have a regular frequent observation of our reservoir storage and combine this in a modeling fashion, hopefully improve our understanding of this entire system. So another mission that we use a lot is the Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment, or GRACE. This is a very unique mission, and this is it measures terrestrial water storage. So what it does, it provides monthly estimates of global terrestrial water storage, all the water that's stored from snowpack, soil moisture, groundwater. And it does this not by looking, I think I have a better... Yeah, here it is. So what's really cool about this, it's one of the few, or if only, instruments that's really not using any component of the electromagnetic spectrum for monitoring the Earth. There's two satellites that are flying in tandem, and they're looking at each other with a very, very high-resolution radiometer. I think it measures the accuracy of one red blood cell. And what it's recording is this horizontal distance between the two satellites. And so as they pass over the Earth, there's areas where the crust of the Earth is thicker over a mountain. So there's slightly more gravitational pull here. So this first satellite will be pulled forward just slightly, and that'll change that horizontal distance. And eventually when they go over the mountain, they're closer together. And then once they pass, the second satellite will be lagging. So from that, they can infer a gravitational or anomaly map of the Earth. And so month after month after month, you get a picture of these changes in terrestrial water storage, or changes in the gravity anomalies, rather. And from this, you can infer a movement in water. So as in hydrology and global hydrology and regional hydrology, this is really a game changer, because we're always trying to solve for... in the water budget, trying to solve for groundwater. Here we actually have a direct observation of that change in storage. It does have a very coarse resolution, so on the order of 300 kilometers. But There's a lot of work that can be done with it. It's a cool tool. So taking all these observations and combining them with the land surface model structure, hopefully if you combine this with a physically based model, you can constrain your hydrological model states and fluxes to a point where you reduce the uncertainty of that model overall. So if you have, even if you have a 300 kilometer spatial resolution footprint, if you're able to combine this in the data simulation fashion, you can spatially disaggregate that. And you can in some ways, you can help constrain that terrestrial water storage of the model. So in fact, this is being done. And I'll show a little bit of this. So this is being done through the integration with land data assimilation systems, or LDASs. And of note, so within Goddard is the GMAO, the Global Modeling Assimilation Office. And we also developed this global estimates of the LDAS. There's GLDAS and there's NLDAS estimates are being performed. And every year we are able to add more and more of these satellite observations combined with in-situ observations. So the whole key is in areas where you're lacking ground observations, this is where you're really going to add value to your model and hopefully be able to inform decision-making by adding these observations from satellite. So back to the blue marble applications. So this one, hopefully it works. I got some help with this. This is pretty cool. So Bob Ross would be so happy if you saw this. So these are real observations. What this is a paired, the yellow and red are GPM observations. So that's precipitation. And the blue and orange are anomalies of soil moisture. And you can see in this concept of soil moisture is a memory of precipitation. And you can just see how the precipitation or just paints the land surface here. And eventually you see a drying of the soil. And what's great about this isn't modeled, this is observed. And it's a great way of sort of relating the coolness of using Earth observations, but it's been very helpful for us to look at. But this is essentially what we're after, trying to combine in a meaningful fashion different data sets that can help us understand the hydrology of the system. So, and this can play. And also what it does, it tells you in areas where, you know, you have estimates of precipitation, but did that precipitation actually reach the ground or did it evaporate? In some areas you'll see here where you have soil moisture anomalies without a precipitation observation. So this is helping scientists sort of calibrate and validate even the precipitation data to a further degree. So soil moisture. I mentioned earlier, it can be a leading indicator of vegetation. And this is also over Australia. And what we're looking at here is the normalized difference vegetation indices, or just an estimate of vegetation or a biomass, rather. A time series of this combined in blue is the soil moisture. And you can see the soil moisture leads the vegetation by a month or so. And this is critical if you're in the business of doing agricultural forecasting, having even a month or two advanced forecasting of this, it could be huge. In fact, it is. So, and what we're trying to do now is combine these to have an even a better indice for monitoring agricultural drought. So, how can we improve global crop forecasts? So, this is work that's being done with the USDA Foreign Agricultural Service. So they're in the business of providing monthly global estimates of global crop productivity. And, you know, I scared everyone with the global population statistics and things, but agriculture really is a global enterprise now. So the cost of corn in the United States, it depends on the productivity of corn in Central Asia and South America. And so what they do is they provide global estimates every month of this. And here's an image of South Africa. And this is the previous model. It's a modeled-only product. So their model is based on precipitation. Precipitation is it's notorious for having very high uncertainty, and the accuracy is highly correlated with the density of gauges. In South Africa, there's very few gauges. In fact, they don't even provide estimates over this. So we came and saved the day by combining this with satellite-observed soil moisture. And you can see an increase in spatial distribution of the soil moisture, and also there's a root zone product for this. So this is an operational product. The USDA, they're head over heels about it. Or I got a comment from one of the analysts, and he said, for the first time in 20 years, we have a reliable estimate of soil moisture in South Africa. So for me, that's a slam dunk, and I was posting it on my office door and put it on my fridge, send it to my parents. It was great. And that's what I was going to tell the president today, but anyway, no. The carrot cake was amazing. Anyways. So this also shows us. So we can, in addition to just correcting in areas where you don't have gauge data, you correct for artifacts in the other data sets. So here's a huge artifact over India of precipitation, and you combine this. We're using an ensemble common filter data simulation approach. More or less, the idea is that you know your model has error, and you know your observations have error. But through time and different areas, those uncertainties are weighted differently. And that's the game you play with data assimilation. And so we've worked out a way of weighting these uncertainties based on, actually, we use the density of gauge data. So I say, hey, well, anywhere where there's a low density of rain observations, increase your gain in for your soil moisture observation. So that's cool. So if you look at this, okay, well, that's great. Well, it turns out that areas that are poorly gauged also tend to be food insecure regions. And these are areas that need it most. So if you look at Somalia, Angola, all these areas, these lines, what you're seeing in the black is the modeled only, or the previous model. This is what USDA was using before we came along and said we could help. And the red is your increase in correlation. So what we did, and this is all using real observations too. This isn't a modeled thing to saying we're doing a great job, but all we did is we did a lag correlation. I say, well, I expect a soil moisture anomaly today to correlate with next month's vegetation anomaly. You know, and so how does that correlation change in 1 month and 2 month and 3 month lag? And in fact, we see in these areas, we get a huge increase. Well, a relatively huge increase in correlation, and that's great. So what we're doing is we're showing that we can definitely add value to their current global crop forecasting system. And the areas in red here, this colored map, basically red is good. Red shows you everywhere we're outperforming the old model by doing that. So that's great. So how can we improve end-of-season yield forecast? So the USDA is also... over the U.S., they have the National Agricultural Statistical Service. And what they do is they provide a county-level estimate of end-of-season yield. Okay, this is a survey-based. So they have guys that go out there and they take observations of corn and soybean. And they're constantly doing this. So... And you can see, well, what we did, we said, well, how can, well, maybe we can improve that. Maybe we can assist them or help them with their end of season yield. So, this is evaporative stress index. I can't really see. This is vegetation. And this is evaporative transpiration. And through time, so the red, the warmer colors are a higher correlation with end of season yield, right? And these are a bunch of different modeled soil moisture. We took a bunch of different hydrologic models. We took our Palmer model only, and then we assimilated soil moisture from AMSR into it. We took another land surface model. And then we compared it here, this NAS. This is the survey-based. So these are their county-level surveys. This is the best they have. And they're showing, you know, through time, okay, this county, you see here, this is July and August. over these counties in the states, I think we aggregated up, they have a high correlation with end of season yield. What turns out, when we merge a couple of our model soil moisture, our simulated soil moisture, and our vegetation indices, we get a comparable or in some places an improved estimate of end of season yield compared with survey based. That's awesome. We're doing this from satellites and from numerical modeling. It's great. We're going to put these guys out of business. Actually, we won't, but it's great, because I think if you can do this and you can sort of demonstrate the utility of taking these Earth observations, taking these model data, and really hopefully improve end-of-season yield and apply this in other areas. So that's vegetation. Now, floods. There are a few scary statistics about floods. But, you know, over 90% of global natural hazards are water-related, and floods are a big problem. I live about a mile from Ellicott City, Maryland, where there was a major, super scary flash flood about 2 months ago, and I went down there. I went into a record shop. I bought a Japanese pressing of Led Zeppelin IV, and I was talking to the guy about how he got into selling records, and he's like, well, I do this, you know, I'm selling records. What do you do? And I was like, oh, I'm hydrology. What's that? And I was like, well, study flooding. And he goes, oh, okay, cool. I saw him the next day. He gave me a hug and he goes, hydrology. It's a true story. So, I'm not going to repeat all these things. So how can we address global flooding or regional flooding? This is a tool I'm really excited about. We just developed this in the past 2 years, and this is working in Southeast Asia with different stakeholders in the region. And this is a MODIS-based product, so it's pretty simple. We're just looking at vegetation, saying, well, okay, in areas where it floods, it's going to be covering some vegetation, and that's going to reflect a rise in water, so that it can show you areas where it's flooding. Okay, that's great. A lot of people have been doing that, but what no one's ever done is they haven't tied this into socioeconomic data. Say, okay, great, it's flooding. Who cares? My boots are going to get wet. But if you can say, oh, well, here are the number of schools that are at risk from this recent flood. This is these are the areas where the infrastructure is affected. This is your percentage of your population that is currently at risk from a flood that happened hours ago. So this is operationally moving. If you go to this website right now, you can see what's happening, and it's great. And this is really what we're after. The big game changer is it's being able to really inform decisions and saying, well, these are areas that are currently under flooding. This is what you can do. So I'm very excited about it. And this was done by a student, by the way. He had this idea. He's like, hey, maybe we can do this. And I'll just plug the NASA Develop Program. So if there's students in the audience that you think this is interesting, or you want to come work at NASA Goddard, we have the largest gathering of Earth scientists in the world. And we have an amazing education outreach program. So, and I actually lead the internship program down there. So please talk with me. And okay, so applying TRIM precip for landslide hazards. Are you guys still awake? Because I know I'm just rattling off all this kind of stuff. But we do a lot of neat things. And this is saying, well, hey, well, we know landslides are related to precipitation. I was in Nepal 2 weeks ago, in Kathmandu and surrounding area. They had major earthquake and a lot of landslide issues. So we're working with regional stakeholders there, a group called ECMOD, and taking all these data, all these fancy tools, and working with their scientists and their engineers and their water managers, and implementing these new systems. In fact, the flood system I just showed we were shopping that around and saying, here you go, you can have it. So if you look at here, the 24-hour rainfall estimate, the 72-hour, and 168-hour rainfall estimate, if you look down here in South America, provide estimates of landslide hazards. And this turns out to be a really popular tool for areas in these regions, as you would expect, in South America, or in Nepal, actually, in landslide potential. So I mentioned SWOT. SWOT was the soil, water, ocean topography, the satellite-based altimetry product. Well, there's a couple satellites that have been doing something similar to this, but not yet at the resolution that they're doing. But it's very telling if you look at trends in reservoir storage. If you look at trends, if you look at this over the Aral Sea, I mean, it'll make you cry, or over Lake Chad. It's crazy. Look at this change in water storage. But if you say, well, you know what? Why do I need a satellite? I can just go out. It's pretty easy to get a water level sensor and do that. But there's millions of reservoirs all over the world, and it's astonishing how many are not monitored. And especially if you're trying to tell the story of the blue marble and do a global hydrology, it's even more important to have a continuous observation globally. So there's an airborne system. This is the Jet Propulsion Lab in NASA in California. They fly this airborne snow observatory. So most of the water that's sourced for California is from snowpack. And I'll show a couple figures here. But how do they estimate, or how do they monitor snowpack? And how can they forecast future stream flow and future water availability for the region? So they're using similar observations, actually, near infrared, invisible, and LIDAR observations for mapping snowfall and snowpack. And then they take this and they have, this is the snow water equivalent estimate over the basin in 2016. You can see it increasing through time. You can see it decreasing in the springtime. Oh, that's really pretty and great. But where the rubber meets the road is actually where you integrate this into a hydrologic model, and you provide basin managers with an improved forecast of stream flow. And in fact, that's what we're showing here. So this gray line is stream flow observations, and this water is sourced from snowpack, right? The red line is the modeled before integrating or assimilating these airborne observations. So you have it's closer to reality, we say. So you have an improved estimate. This is great. And so this is a partnership with the state of California and the Western Water Group as well. Big thing in the Central Valley, the effect of the current drought is there's subsidence over land. And it's pretty wild that you can use a satellite to observe this subsidence. And so they're taking these observations of subsidence and relating this to the amount of water that must be lost for that amount of subsidence to have happened. Okay, a lot of other things. We've been focusing on California drought, the amount of crops and land that have been left idle and fallowed over time. And you can see the effect in Sacramento Valley alone. And I think these shouldn't be the same dates. But you can see the increase, and I don't have the statistic here handy. Or maybe I do. Well, anyway, it was a lot. So a lot of the land was fallowed because of that. And that resulted in a loss of food, loss of jobs, and a lot of income was lost from this. So how do we assist growers in this for optimizing water use? The first part of it is to characterize that water availability and the water use. And that's in fact what they're doing. So we've gone from using satellite data to taking this down to cell phone apps. So the farmers in these regions have been given cell phone apps with near real time observations of agriculture in the area based on MODIS, and estimating areas of fallowed land and whatnot. But on a bigger scale, taking all this, and okay, we're going to finally get to how we do this. This is with the USGS combined effort with NOAA as well, the National Drought Monitor, right? But taking these GRACE observations of terrestrial water storage and taking them in there and increasing the drought monitor estimates, before it was based on precipitation and modeled soil moisture and temperature and whatnot, but now we've been assimilating observations of GRACE and terrestrial water storage, and we actually have an additional drought indice of groundwater indice. So if you go to this, well, I thought I had the link up there, but look at the U.S. drought monitor. So that's a new addition to that. So taking all this going, we went from population, we went from the percentage of where is the water really? And where is the water use in areas of irrigated land? So take areas of high irrigated land, that groundwater sourced irrigation, Northwest India in particular, we see a dramatic increase in the terrestrial water trend over that area using GRACE. And in fact, that's what this is. So on this time series here, this is really neat because the red is soil moisture. So if there was a farmer out there, you don't see a trend in soil moisture over time. The black line is the terrestrial water, total terrestrial water storage. And we're seeing this dramatic trend in groundwater it's just an amazing amount of groundwater sourced irrigation in that area. And at these trends and the key point here is these are unsustainable trends. These are unsustainable water withdrawals. So this resonated a lot in this area. It was published, I think, in Nature or something, in the area. So Rodell and others are now working with India and water managers in this region to try to say, okay, well, let's see if we can further improve water resource management. Now that we see that we have this observation of decreasing groundwater trends. You can also use this terrestrial water storage in GRACE for looking at flood potential. If you think over time, the amplitude of these signals, the amplitude of your terrestrial water storage, kind of gives you an idea how much water is stored in the soil, right? And if you look at this terrestrial water storage anomaly over time with your precipitation anomaly over time, you have a storage deficit, and you can see areas where the amplitude is greater or is less than the precipitation. Those are areas where you have high flow potential. It's an interesting way of, you know, saying, well, if the bucket's full and these are areas where you're going to have higher runoff and flooding. But you do this on a global scale, and it's very telling. So, and then you can here, and if you do this on a global scale, and just look at GRACE trends and see what's happening. There's drought recovery in Australia, in areas in red. You have particularly in Asia. In India, we see a lot of water withdrawal. So from a global standpoint, using GRACE can drastically improve your understanding of global hydrology. So as I mentioned before, that GRACE is a huge, huge footprint, right? But where its value is realized is by combining it in a meaningful fashion with a physically based model. And so over the Mississippi Basin, they were looking at, this is Zychek et al., and they looked at to see how they could compare with observed groundwater by downscaling, doing a spatial disaggregation of this huge, giant GRACE footprint over the area, so with interesting results. So this is actually a neat figure. So the red area is soil moisture, blue is groundwater, and white is snowpack. And GRACE is observing all this. But you have to integrate this into a model to do a vertical disaggregation. What percentage of that signal is groundwater and what percentage is soil moisture? So that's where you really need to combine it with other data sets. Okay, in the California drought, this is neat. So on the left, you see a time series. Over time, you see a trend in terrestrial water storage changes in California. And just over time, you can see this is going to get redder and redder and redder and redder. And this was all over the news, and it still is. And it's made a it's influenced actually groundwater and freshwater management practices in California. And so the JFL McLeady is and JPL is now working with the Western States Water Council and all these groups to help address this decline in groundwater. So, the blue marble. Getting back to the applied sciences program. So, what these are a few examples of what we've done. Right now, this is our current portfolio, and we actually have 12 new projects that aren't on this list. They're just about to be announced. But essentially, what this is taking working with stakeholders, with end users who have the need and have the technical ability to apply these earth observations and technologies. And that's what the Applied Sciences program's after. So I encourage everyone, if you're curious, if you're interested in looking at how if you can perhaps be involved with the Applied Sciences program, please let me know. And we have a website that gives you a summary of our NASA Applied Sciences Program, water resources, projects, and portfolio, and whatnot. Another project I mentioned briefly is the SURVEIR program. There's a lot more applied sciences than just water resources. In fact, the SURVEIR is in the capacity building program. And it's a huge regional component, or several regions. And I think that's it. I'm not sure how I did. 302. So thank you so much.
John, thank you. I'm sure there's lots of a broad range of questions. We do have some time for a few. I think we've got one back there.
Hi. Oh, sorry.
Hi.
Oh. Hi. I have two questions for you.
Sure.
What is your background is the first, and the second is what can we as civilians and hydro professionals do to help steward our water short of joining NASA?
Well, my background is in geology, actually. Geology and hydrogeology. Studied at West Virginia. Then I studied in South Carolina and also geology. And I did that. And as far as how you can steward your water resource short of joining NASA. Some of the biggest advances that we've had, meaning we as in applied sciences, water resources, have been from the science community outside of NASA. And the only way for the applied sciences program to move forward, for us to make any meaningful impact, is to have engaged users of the data. And one of the biggest challenges for us is this ongoing dialogue and help in basically meeting groups that are willing to and can sustain and develop these technologies with us. So there's a huge portfolio of projects that we have that I'd be happy to share with you, and if you go on our website, of groups that are doing this. And it's not and some of them are short-lived, some of them are 1 to 4 year projects. But if you go on our website, you can get an idea of some of the examples and ways that we're working with small firms, we're working with on the county level, regional level, and we're also working internationally, obviously, in several fashions. That was sort of a roundabout answer, but you have to join NASA, I'm sorry.
Yep. Dr. Bolton, just wondering, from your abstract, it talks about both, satellites, airborne, groundborne sensors being able to help with both quantity and quality of water resources. I'm just wondering, to what extent can satellites measure groundwater quality and what types of quality measurements can be gleaned from those measurements?
Well, it might be a typo because it's surface water quality, not groundwater quality. I hope that wasn't in there. I didn't really discuss water quality, but monitoring river turbidity and monitoring nitrogens and chlorophyll is a big part of what we do. In fact, I told some people this at lunch, but the EPA in Florida, for the first time ever, their nutrient requirements are now based solely on Earth observations. Well, maybe not solely, but in addition to. So, and this is because of the cost of this frequent monitoring of water quality. But as far as groundwater quality, I'm sorry. I hope that wasn't in there.
Interest in these types of tools and how that might change in the future of the crop insurance program and insurance in general?
Is the question how insurance and reinsurance agencies are interested?
Yeah.
It's actually a huge it's an emerging field, I think, the reinsurance and insurance groups. But it's big business trying to really understand the improving forecasts of crops. It's enormous. And this is being done, we're working with wineries in California. We're working with, and they're using UAVs, combining this with in-situ observations. We're working with states at the county level. And USDA as a whole, obviously, they have their operational crop forecasting system, but it's a sort of job security, I think, for a lot of people that are involved with water and in agriculture. Sure.
I've got one for you, John.
Oofta. That's the first time I've ever used that. Did I do it right? Was it awesome?
So I know that your role is mostly to collect data and communicate the data, but one of my issues is always with agriculture in California and how it seems like pistachio groves and almond orchards are just really, while the sunshine is perfect there, the precipitation is absolutely not perfect there, and they're doing a ton of irrigating. Is there, how forcefully can you suggest to an industry like that, if at all?
I'm a geologist.
Whether that's a good idea or not. You know, do you struggle with, you know, being able to see things you can't change?
Well, I'll just tell you a story. Last year I sat through an entire conference like this, and the topic of the day was how feasible is it to move California's agriculture to Southeast United States. And it blew my mind. But you know, as far as focusing on cash crops versus focusing on other crops that are more drought resilient and appropriate for the region, that's way beyond my pay grade. But I think what we can do, rather than, I think if you approach it from a pragmatic way and say, well, this is what would happen if change did not happen. The best way to do that, and the best way to I think, not change anyone's mind, but really just educate them, is to improve and tell the story better. And that's what we're doing through this. Hopefully, that's what we're doing through our improved modeling and the sensor observations I saw this morning. That's really the best way to do it. You say, well, this is what's happening, and this is what would happen if things didn't change. The rest is up to you. And that's what I would do. I don't know. That's what I'm trying to do.
Okay, well, thank you once again, John.